All right, then thank you for coming this evening. I am Mordechai Kuchiner, and this program, run by the Yeshiva University Torah Mitzvah Beit Midrash Zichro Nedov, is a by popular demand program, which is to say that we do, I don't know, five or six legal ethics topics a year. We try to have CPD credit for them. When they came out with the EDI program, I said no the first, I don't know, half a dozen or so emails that came in asking me if I would do one. But at a certain point, it became easier to just say yes. So fine. That's what we're doing tonight. We are indeed approved for 1.5 hours of EDI credit, for as long as EDI credit means something, which we're going to talk about a little bit later in terms of what the future of EDI actually is. But a little bit of history. There was a recommendation made in 2011 by what was then known as the Law Society of Upper Canada, since rebranded. But based on that recommendation, the Law Society hired a firm to run a survey of law licensees on what's called, quote, challenges facing racialized licensees. Racialized meaning people who are grouped together with others by race based on the views of others or their own self-identification. So the survey ran in mid-2013, and they reported the following. Take a look at the first source, please, on your sheet, and you'll see it there. Racialized licensees reported lower success rates across a range of key measures related to articling/training placement, finding a suitable first job, finding employment in a suitable practice environment. They said it's harder to be able to achieve these different stages of a law practice from the beginning, from articling, well, not law school here, but from articling through first job and so on. Racialized licensees were twice as likely as their non-racialized counterparts to report less rapid career advancement than their colleagues with similar qualifications. And racialized licensees were twice as likely as non-racialized to report having felt disadvantaged in law school. So some of the specific issues that they talked about were having trouble because of having a different accent, having trouble because they weren't raised in Canada, not speaking English or French as well as others, having had training outside of Canada, not having a professional network, not sharing cultural background with others, experiencing prejudice from others. And they contended that the challenges that they face affect the entire profession, because they affect the reputation of the legal system in the eyes of the public. It affects access to justice as well for potential clients who don't have the possibility of representation by someone they feel will understand their position. And it affects the quality of legal services. That was the result of this survey. And as a result of it, various recommendations were made and approved in 2016, including requiring CPD programs on topics of equality and inclusion in the professions. And that's what this session is about. And you know, again, when I was asked to speak on the topic, really the part of it that attracted me isn't really about the practice of law. It's the issue of racism in Judaism, which will figure into the issue of the practice of law eventually. But that to me is really the most interesting piece of it. If you take a look at source number two, Rav Aaron Soloveitchik, if you're familiar with Rabbi Yosef Dov Soloveitchik, this is his younger brother. And Rav Aaron Soloveitchik wrote an essay called Civil Rights and the Dignity of Man, in which he said, from the standpoint of the Torah, there can be no distinction between one human being and another on the basis of race or color. Any discrimination shown to a human being on account of the color of his or her skin constitutes loathsome barbarity. A fairly clear-cut statement, and the sort of statement that those who have familiarity with Rav Aaron himself or his writings will not be surprised to hear. But it does raise certain questions. First of all, is that true? Is there really nothing in Judaism that is racist? No, I'll ask the question. I didn't ask whether there are Jews who are racist, because that was a lot easier to answer. But the question of, is there nothing in Judaism that is racist? Morris?
The example of unhuman slaves, I mean, there's a distinction between Jewish slaves and non-Jewish slaves. Kanani.
Right, but that's not based on race.
Well,
what? Eved Kanani is anybody. Anybody who's not Jewish.
Not Jewish.
Right.
So, I mean,
So that's a very interesting point. That's a very interesting point. I'm glad that you brought it up. Otherwise, I was going to have to bring it up later. There's a distinction to be drawn between making distinctions based on race and making distinctions based on religion. Whether you like or don't like either of those, it's important to recognize they're not the same thing. So we're going to come back to that because I think we need to discuss that.
But my language interest.
Also, religion-based. Correct.
It's
religion-based rather than race-based, and also something that we're going to have to discuss. Yeah. Good. So there's an example of something that does seem to be race-based, and that's Amalek, the biblical commandment to remember that Amalek attacked us. They were our first enemy, the first one to attack the Jews when they left Egypt, and they attacked repeatedly, incessantly, and in particularly cruel ways. Further along in Tanakh, and the command biblically is, eliminate them. And it is entirely race-based. It's not color-based, but it's race-based, absolutely. Cheryl. Right, there's a prohibition that the Jews are given when they're traveling again through the desert into the land of Canaan, that they are not allowed to marry among certain tribes based on their actions, and one of them was indeed the nation of Moab. Yes?
The Shivam, I mean, the Canaan, and the fact that Losachai called the Shavah would.
Well, there it's religion-based rather than race-based, meaning that, as Rambam Maimonides writes, they can choose to accept the seven Noahide laws, and then there's no such command. So it's really religion-based rather than race. Race, by definition, is something which you are born with and you can never get out of, as opposed to something which is based on covenant, which again we're going to come back to. But I think what we've established with a number of the examples here is that the statement that Rabbi Aaron Soloveitchik makes in source number 2, there could be no distinction between one human being and another on the basis of race or color, requires an awful lot of explaining in light of what we do see in the Torah. That's number 1. And then number 2 is not being racist the same thing as being in favor of racial diversity. Is it possible to suggest that a person might not be racist, but on the other hand say, I don't see particular value in racial diversity in a workplace, in a profession, and so on? I think it's an important distinction to recognize. So what I want to do is first talk about the question of racism in Judaism, and that's going to be I think sort of an outsized portion of this, because I think it is really important. And then second, does Judaism recognize value in racial diversity? And then the third topic, which is the one that I got the most email about, which is, would Judaism approve compulsory diversification? The idea that a firm will have to make a statement about its policies, the idea that you will be required to hire with diversity in mind, those elements of it, where will Judaism be on that? But let's go first. The issue of racism in Judaism. So I want to come back to the question that we've already noted a couple of times, which is the issue of race as opposed to the issue of religion. When it comes to Judaism, this is always a challenge, right? Because there are those who like to define Judaism as an ethnicity, and there are those who like to define Judaism as a religion, and the truth of the matter is, it's neither. Or to put it more accurately, it's both. Right? You know that it's not a race. How do you know it's not a race? Because you can convert. Right? It's not by birth. A person is able to join Judaism. If it were truly race-based, then feeling an affinity and saying you want to practice your rules isn't going to make you a Jew. The very fact that somebody can convert to Judaism says Judaism is not a race. On the other hand, the fact that Judaism teaches that if you are born to Jews, you are Jewish, whether you believe it, whether you practice it, does not make a difference. You can't convert out in the eyes of Jewish law. Tells you that there is an ethnic aspect to it. There is a biological aspect to it. You can't really get out of that. Rav Aaron Lichtenstein wrote an excellent essay on this point, in which he noted that when the Talmud gives the text that is stated to somebody who wants to join the Jewish people, somebody wants to convert, they are told some of the commandments they're accepting, because they're accepting it as a religion, but they're also told you are joining a nation that has experienced the following things. And that suggests that you're joining a nation, you're joining a family. It's not simply about joining a group of people who follow a set of rules. So Judaism is not really race or religion, it's actually both. But when it comes to the issue of a Jewish attitude towards race, you can't mix it with a Jewish attitude towards those who are not Jewish. Because you do have preferences within Jewish law for those who are part of the covenant. Part of the covenant accepted at Sinai. And it's not about race at all. There are Jews of every ethnicity, there are Jews of every color, every nationality. It's about being part of a covenant. One example of this is source number 4 on your sheet. Rabbi Chaim Ibn Attar noted something fascinating, and something that actually should be very relevant for lawyers. Right? Where does the judicial system, the Jewish judicial system, originate in the Torah?
Yitro.
Yitro, exactly. Yitro, who was Jewish or not Jewish?
No.
Not Jewish, correct. Moses' father-in-law, right? He comes to visit, and he sees his son-in-law is sitting and judging the people all day long. And he says, you can't do this. And the nation can't do it, right? This is time-honored Jewish in-law tradition. He may not have been Jewish, but he knew exactly what to do. He showed up, he saw what his son-in-law was doing, he corrected him, and he left. That's the job description. So he says to him, you can't manage all of this yourself. What you need to do is create a hierarchy of courts. And that's why it's presented in the Torah, and God approves it. Leading the Jewish sages to ask, why is it that the Torah waits for Yitro, for Moshe's father-in-law, to tell him to do this? Why didn't God just say it? Why wait for him to give this instruction? So take a look at Rabbi Chaim Ibn Attar's comment in source number 4. For the sources, I bring the Hebrew, but I'm going to read the translations out loud in the interest of time. It appears that God did this, my comment in brackets, presenting the judicial hierarchy of courts as the idea of Yitro, to show the children of Israel in that generation and every generation that the nations, the world, include giants of understanding and insight. Learn from Yitro's insightful counsel. For Israel was not selected due to greater insight and sense than other nations, but due to divine kindness and love for their ancestors. The Jews are picked not because they are wonderful and better than everybody else. It's just not true. It's a covenant that starts with Abraham and Sarah and then continues down the line, accepted at Sinai. And that covenant says, those who have accepted this, those who are in this relationship with God, who have agreed to this pact, deserve special treatment as your family. So somebody mentioned here, I forget where, the laws of interest, right? Judaism has a rule which says, for others who are members of this covenant, give interest-free loans. Don't charge interest. By the way, Christianity and Islam both adopted the same principle among themselves historically. The rationale is straightforward. What is the technical economic term for an interest-free loan? Not a gift. Suicide. Right? No, that's the economic term for an interest-free loan. Because in your best-case scenario, you got paid back on time, and all you lost was opportunity cost and inflation. But you're always going to lose. Right? Unless you're really bad at investing, in which case you were better off losing the opportunity cost. But otherwise, that's your best-case scenario. Right? It could be you're not going to get paid back at all. It could be you're going to have to run after the person. It could be you'll get paid back some percentage of what you had lent out. It's a bad idea. The Torah presents interest-free loans as philanthropy. It's meant to be a way to assist somebody who needs capital, such as in order to go into business, in order to pay their rent, whatever it is. That's what it is. And yes, it's mandated specifically on behalf of family. We have other pieces of evidence to this. I don't want to belabor the point, but the idea is fundamentally that it's about the fact that you are members of this covenant with God. If you take a look at source number 5, Rabbi Soloveitchik makes this point himself when he says, it must be conceded that the Torah recognizes a distinction between a Jew and a non-Jew. This distinction, however, is not based on race, origin, or color, but rather upon kiddushah, holiness, the holiness endowed by having been given and having accepted the Torah. Furthermore, the distinction between Jew and non-Jew does not involve any concept of inferiority, but is based primarily upon the unique and special burdens that are incumbent upon the Jews. That's what makes it special. Perhaps the best proof of this is the story which is read on the upcoming holiday of Shavuot in the synagogue. Right, various holidays have a special Megillah, a special scroll that is read on that day. What's the reading for Shavuot? The story of Ruth. Who's the hero in the book of Ruth? Ruth. Right? That's the good person in the book of Ruth, is Ruth, who was a Moabite, who then came and joined the Jews. Most of the Jews in that story, not so good. On the holiday when we commemorate, among other things, the giving of the Torah to the Jewish people, it's the one who converted in who stands as the hero. That's in terms of Jew and non-Jew. But when it comes to the question that we are here about, the racism question, you have to know that the story really is more complex. Take a look at source number 6. This is a favorite in this conversation. This is after the flood. Noah and his family come out of the teva, out of the boat, and Noah tries to bring a sacrifice to God. God sees human beings have learned generosity. They've learned how to give. This is wonderful. I'm never going to destroy the world again because they've learned selflessness. And Noah gets drunk. That's your next story. He gets drunk, he is exposed in his tent, and his son Ham is the one who finds him. Ham is identified as the father of Canaan. Why Canaan is brought into this is a good question, but not for right now. The point is what you see in number 6. When Noah wakes up, he says, "Cursed is Canaan, a slave of slaves he shall be to his brethren." That biblical sentence was used for centuries to justify the enslavement of people from Africa. Now, why does that make no sense? It's not Canaan. Correct. Ham had 4 sons. Cush, Mitzrayim, Put, and Canaan. Those are his 4 sons. Cush is Ethiopia. Put is usually in the area of Libya. Mitzrayim is Egypt. Canaan is what it sounds like. Canaan, which would of course become Israel. That's, this is what's usually called the Hamitic myth. The idea that somehow this verse will justify the enslavement of Africans. And a friend of mine, a fellow by the name of Jonathan Schorsch, wrote a doctorate on the relation between blacks and Jews in North America, I think starting in the 14th century or 15th century and running until the 19th century. And in it he brought how Christian theologians frequently referred to this verse. Most Jews, although not all, knew enough to steer clear of using that as any sort of a justification. But even if the biblical text does not justify a racist approach to slavery, the fact of the matter is that it can be read to support a racial approach to aesthetics. To say that a certain color is more attractive, a certain color is less attractive. If you take a look at source number 7, the story of Moshe, of Moses and his siblings, Aaron and Miriam. And Miriam and Aaron spoke regarding Moshe, regarding the Cushite woman, he had taken a Cushite woman. He had married a woman who was Cushite. Now, there's a lot of dispute about how to understand this sentence, because who was Moses' wife? Zipporah. Zipporah was from Midian. She wasn't from Cush. So there's a lot of discussion about who exactly they're talking about. Is it Zipporah? Is it somebody else? But at least some And if you take a look at source number 8, you see it in Rabbi Avraham Ibn Ezra. At least some assume that it is saying that the looks associated with a Cushite, Cush being Ethiopia, would be considered inferior. There was an allegation that Moses had separated from his wife because he didn't like the way she looked. Not everybody who read that text agreed that that was the read. If you take a look at number 9 on the next page, the classic commentator Rashi said absolutely not. He says she was identified as beautiful. There are many other verses that can be brought in the direction of saying that the biblical aesthetic likes darkness or does not like darkness. Another example, a verse in Shir HaShirim in Song of Songs, Shchora Ani V'Nava, I am black and beautiful. Or could be read by some, I am black but beautiful. It can be done in different ways. But really, the issue of aesthetics and whether there is some kind of biblical aesthetic, which is debatable, isn't really the core of what racism is about. What is racism fundamentally? What is racism?
Dislike of a person of color.
Dislike of a person of color? Or of a particular ethnicity, because it doesn't have to be about color. That could be. I think you can go broader. Distinction, usually pejorative. Prejudice.
The assumption that they're inferior.
Assumption of inferiority? I'm hearing two different things, and I think there's a reason for that. Because I think there really are two different aspects to racism. No, you're fine. But you're a step ahead of me because you're already talking about why someone would be racist. I'm still trying to figure out what racist is. I think there are two components. I think on the one hand, there is judgment of an individual member of a race based on positive or negative traits that are assumed to belong to the race in general. I have certain beliefs about what people from Japan are like, and I'm going to assume it about anybody I meet who is from Japan. That's racist in and of itself, meaning it's racial thinking. It's me making assumptions about every member of the race based on a particular representative. Then there's the second one, which is negative. As Michael said, usually pejorative, in which I associate negative traits with a particular race. Two different issues. The first component exists within Judaism, meaning the first one I described, the idea that we will extrapolate from certain members of a race to the race as a whole and make assumptions that there are characteristics of that race that can be assumed in the race in general. I think you can't really deny that it exists in Judaism, again, whether positive or negative. It's something society does too, but I think Judaism does it. If you take a look at source number 10, this is an essay that appeared last year. Rabbi Dr. Shlomo Carmi was talking about, as you see in the title of his essay, is contemporary Orthodox Judaism racist? Some informal remarks. Yes, the title sounds like clickbait, but it actually did. He addressed the topic. So he writes there, as we all know, such distinctions, meaning distinguishing based on race, saying there are certain traits that belong to the race as a whole, have been common in Western scientific, humanistic, and popular culture. In the 19th century, two psychologists who were brothers-in-law, Hermann Steinthal and Moritz Lazarus, who played active roles in German Reform Judaism, established, I'm not going to mispronounce that, the psychology of nations as an academic discipline, meaning the psychology of nations, the psychology that assigns certain traits to particular national identities. And down to the present day, Books are written containing breezy generalizations about sunny Italians and morose Scandinavians, mixing speculations about biological nature with social and geographical factors. We are all familiar with the kind of joke that associates Germans with beer, Frenchmen with wine, Englishmen with gin and tonic, and Jews with diabetes. In the article, he has a link to a website where you can find the joke in case you don't know it, so you can Google and find the article and you can see the joke there. Sometimes the speaker is earnest and chauvinistic and the humor appears only in retrospect. Historians of hay fever smile at the influential Victorian physician Sir Andrew Clark's Havdalah-like glorification of the malady that supposedly chooses, quote, the man before the woman, the educated before the ignorant, the gentle before the rude, the courtier before the clown, and out of every climate that it visits, it chooses for its subjects the Anglo-Saxon, or at least the English-speaking race. I didn't know that about hay fever at all. Is that familiar to people? This is new to me. Okay. In any case, society does it, like it or not. And within Judaism, if you go back to Tanakh, back to Scripture, you find this kind of assumption. For example, that story that I mentioned before, the story in which we are told that Ham and his son Canaan are involved in shaming their father when he is drunk. If you take a look at source number 11, Rabbi Avraham Ibn Ezra, writing in Muslim Spain, beginning of the 11th century, writes, Ham is the father of Canaan, teaches that both were bad, and as the ancestors do, so the children will do. There is a racial trait that you can look later on at the descendants of Canaan, and you are going to find that continue. Someone asked me, when people were just coming in, whether I was going to talk about Amalek, which we already mentioned during the questions before. Amalek, again, a nation that is marked for destruction. Take a look at source number 12, at one justification that was given in the 19th century for the command to wipe out Amalek. The seven nations are different, for they sin themselves and perform repulsive things and are liable for death. This is the discussion about religion rather than race. But the seed of Amalek seem to be punished for the sin of their ancestors, for it is known to God their hatred is stored in their heart. And he gives you an example. Haman from the Purim story is said to be from Amalek, and look, he tried to destroy the Jews. And when they hold to their ancestors' activities, it says he recalls the sins of ancestors for their descendants. So you get this picture of a trait that can be inherited by race, and it continues in rabbinic writing post-biblically. If you take a look at source number 13, this is one example of it. The prophet, or maybe not a prophet, there's a debate as to if he's a prophet or not, but Daniel, who has his own book in Tanakh, so that sort of makes him a prophet automatically, doesn't it? He has a vision of different animals representing different nations. And in his prophecy, he sees one which is a bear. And take a look at number 13. Rabbi Yosef taught, these are the Persians who eat and drink like a bear, who are fleshy like a bear, who are hairy like a bear, and who are restless like a bear. And if that's not a race-driven characterization, I don't know what is. Yes?
Just going back to what I mentioned, the seventh night, nine nations, and you said it's religion-based, but I recall there's a Clay Yucker who seems to take a very similar view to the Avnei Nezer, that the reason that Abraham didn't want Yitzchak to marry someone from Canaan was because of certain racial qualities. I don't know if that's...
Right. And here you get the fundamental problem, which is really bigger than what we're going to be able to get to here, but it's worth noting, which is the difference between texts that address law and texts that express philosophies and ideas. And the law tends to need to be more specific and sort of stick to a definition. And other texts don't need to, and then don't. And they'll express ideas that aren't necessarily consistent with the law. So the fact that Maimonides can say that they are able to make peace, and they are able to accept the seven Noahide laws and so forth, tells me that it's not, it can't be race-based. It has to be covenant-based.
Well, we also have the Chazal that says that the great, the B'nai Banim of
Haman taught Torah and B'nai Brah. Yes. Because again, that's fuzzy in the other direction. In other words, now it's making that sound more like it's religion-based as opposed to law-based. But the fuzziness is inherent when you get away from law and into philosophy. Generally speaking, yes?
I guess, in answer to what you said, I saw a documentary a few years ago of the children of Matthew. people's relatives were interviewed, and then the brother and sister were adults, and I think they were the niece and nephew of Goebbels, or one of the big Nazis, and they voluntarily sterilized themselves because they were afraid that they had evil in their DNA, and they were afraid it would be passed down.
Interesting. I don't know what to say besides interesting. I mean, I'm going to be modifying this idea shortly. There's more that we have to say about it. But, yes?
I still don't know what Ron Joseph is saying.
Well, what he's suggesting, what he's really doing is he's analyzing Daniel's vision, which is of nations rising and falling, and saying the bear represents the Persian, but he's trying to explain how he gets that idea, and he says, well, clearly it's an association. You have to remember the way prophecy works. Prophecy, obviously a bigger topic also, but biblical prophecy, it is generally understood, is a message that God will give in some way to a prophet. Depending on the level of the prophet, it will be more clear or less clear. But it takes the form of the images that the prophet is personally familiar with. So prophets who came from rural areas tend to speak much more in rural analogies and terms. Prophets who dealt with royalty and aristocracy in the main cities, on the other hand, will use different terminology and different imagery. So it's what he's saying is, this manifests as a bear for Daniel because of ways in which the Persians would have had traits that would have...
I had a friend who had all these traits and his name was Duff, so...
Okay, maybe he's got... No, no, we have to do Ancestry.com. And yes, one more and then we're going to go further because there's a lot more to say. Yes? Yes. Absolutely. And that's why both are problematic. The point made is that you can't really say, I accept this type of racism and not that type of racism. I'm okay with characterizing people based on race, just not okay with characterizing them in a negative way. Because you go from one to the other very quickly and in the same sentence. So, absolutely. But I want to clarify this further because I think there is greater clarification needed. If you take a look at source number 14, Rabbi Karmi's essay, he talks about how contemporary society has generally dropped the idea of stereotyping based on race. They were discredited morally by Nazism and eventually lost scientific credibility as well. From a scientific point of view, we cannot take it for granted that all such theories are humbug. We cannot rule out a priori the existence of significant practical differences among groups that are discoverable by genetic science. Though it is unlikely, these will turn out to correlate closely with such superficial characteristics as skin pigmentation. However that may be, the religious doctrine of universal human dignity transcends scientific investigations. From a religious perspective, we are not allowed to assign decisive moral significance to potential empirical differences. What he's saying is, it's possible that science is going to discover that certain races really do have certain traits. That people who descend from certain ancestors have greater intelligence in particular areas, greater aptitude in certain activities. It could be. But morally, we don't accept it. Morally, we have a problem with making that kind of assessment. And that brings me back to my statement that in Judaism, you have an application of traits which are extrapolated from one or three or five parties, and even one or three or five parties 30 generations earlier, to the rest of the line down through time. And I think it's really important to recognize that even though biblical text and rabbinic writing assigns race as a default environment in which one enters the world, providing, you might say, nature and nurture upon which one operates, it also views the way life plays out on a meritocratic basis. So, for example, take a look at source number 15, where God explains why he has selected Abraham and Sarah and their descendants. And Abraham will be a great and mighty nation. All of the nations of the land will be blessed through him. For I have loved him, for he will teach his children and his household after him, and they will guard the path of God to perform righteousness and justice. It's not about them being his biological descendants. It's about he's going to teach them to practice righteousness and justice. That's what makes them special to God. It's merit. And if you flip the page to number 16, I took the time to retype this. I didn't have it in a cut and pasteable Hebrew. And I retyped it because I think it's that important. And then translated it as well. Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky, who of course was Trentonian at one point, talks about Judaism and racism. He quotes a passage from the Talmud. He says, "Some of our enemies among the nations of the world claim that the nation of Israel is a racist nation. For the Torah says that Canaan is cursed and will be a slave of slaves to his brethren. The Torah lowered the race of Canaan to the stature of slaves. But the truth is certainly not so. For it is clear that the Torah's view is against racism, as I have already proved earlier from the language of Sanhedrin 37a. This is a Mishnah, a lesson which we're actually going to come back to later, which says, why was humanity created as an individual? In other words, the Talmud is bothered. When God creates all of the other creatures, it's always male and female God created them, and he creates a whole bunch at once. With human beings, it's Adam, and then from Adam, God separates off Eve, and that's how you start. The Talmud asks, why? Lest one say to another, my ancestor was greater than your ancestor. So we don't want a situation in which people claim their line is better than somebody else's line. We see that God specifically altered the human species from other species, creating only a single male so that people would not come to this ugly trait. But because of this, meaning the apparent racism in the curse of Canaan, we must explain Noah's action in degrading Canaan to the level of a slave and lowering him from the status of the rest of humanity. This seems to be an act of pure racism. But in truth, this has no relationship with racism. For racism means that one race elevates itself over another race because of its origin and lineage, as though it were formed of higher and better material and the like. But here, the reason Noach distinguished them was because of the corrupt traits of Ham and his son Canaan, traits which he conveyed to his descendants after him. So he accepts the idea that a race can be condemned, but he believes that it's about traits that they pass on to those who follow them, and therefore if those traits are not passed down, then there's no stigma. That's the way that he looks at it, and it takes us back to Yitro from before. Jerry?
Well, maybe that was the case for a while, but then the Talmud tells you about Sanherib, who was Bilbil Bale as Tolauma.
Yeah.
And he's saying there's a whole new concept now, that because over the years nations intermarried, etc., there aren't these anymore.
Right. So the Talmudic statement that all those races you thought you knew from biblical texts don't exist anymore because the populations have shifted and moved through conquest is certainly true and means that you can't apply any of those racial identities basically for the last, call it, 2,800 years. No, 2,600 years, depending on whose chronology you use. Yes?
But with the modern science and genetic manipulation of the code, you may well destroy your own premise.
Meaning?
Well, I can produce what I want to produce.
Yeah.
It's not passed from generation to generation. I can through the genetic code and produce something that you weren't expecting as a part of that race.
But that actually supports it, because what I'm suggesting is it's the passing of traits educationally that is significant, not biologically.
Well, but biologically and the environment may alter this whole idea of how you react.
Yes, that's true. That's true. So what we're seeing here is that the first aspect of racism, that which extrapolates and applies a principle from a few members of a race to the entire race, does seem to exist in Jewish texts, although as a background, not as a person's full identity, but as a background with which they enter the world, and then they're supposed to grow past any negative that would come from it. The second component, though, the assumption of negative traits as a default trait of a race, that's what Rav Aaron Soloveitchik says we don't countenance within Judaism. And he traces it to a very simple and straightforward biblical verse. If you take a look at source number 17, from Rabbi Soloveitchik's essay. He says, the Torah says in Genesis, in the image of God, he created man. Right? That's not about Jews. That's not about any particular race. It is everybody. This metaphysical idea leads to the halachic principle of kvod habrios, the dignity of man. And the concept of dignity of man is not only a metaphysical concept, but it also has a legal counterpart whose scope is broad enough to include all human beings, since all were created in the image of God. And this idea is contained in the saying of Ben Azai, one of the Talmudic sages, in Pirkei Avot. He says, "Al tehi baz l'chol adam, despise not any man." The expression "any man" implies, as the commentaries say, that even pagans must be treated with respect. It is a sin to despise them, and so forth. Another passage, also associated with Ben Azai, in source number 18 from the Jerusalem Talmud. The Torah says, "Ve'ahavta l'reacha kamocha," love your neighbor as yourself. This was actually very funny. I was outside of a synagogue a couple of weeks ago, and there was a balloon vendor. I guess there was some event going on. They were dropping off balloons. And they had verses, biblical verses, from ours and from theirs, written on the side of the van. And one of the quotes was, "Love your neighbor as yourself." And I think it said Mark. I said, "No, I'm pretty sure that should say Moses. I'm pretty sure." But in any case, the verse says, "Love your neighbor as yourself." And number 18, Rabbi Akiva commented, "This is a great overarching principle in the Torah." And then along comes Ben Azai. And Ben Azai taught, "This is the book of the genealogy of man. Man was created in the image of God. This is an even greater overarching principle. Even greater than love your neighbor as yourself," which has a parochial connotation. It's your neighbor, is the statement of the dignity of all human beings. And Maimonides codified this in source number 19 when he talked about the importance of the dignity of all human beings. He marks a separate dignity for those who, again, observe the covenant of Abraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, but fundamentally, he recognizes dignity for everyone. A friend of mine, Rabbi Daniel Tzvi Feldman, notes that there's actually a problem with saying that I'm going to apply negative traits to a race as a whole from the standpoint of Jewish law. And that is the rule of Lashon Hara. Lashon Hara means what? What is Lashon Hara? Don't give me an example. Sorry? Evil tongue, slander, basically harmful speech. Saying things that are harmful about others, whether true or not true, is prohibited as Lashon Hara. Well, take a look at source number 20. Rabbi Yisrael Meir Kagan, who literally wrote the book on Lashon Hara, notes the following. He talks about people who will slander a community, extrapolating based on their experience with one or two people from that group. He says, many people stumble in this, in our sins, as we see clearly that if someone is not received pleasantly, as he wishes, in a particular town, then when he travels afterward to another town, he advertises ignominiously the important people of that town for not helping him with his business. And certainly shaming an entire town for this is certainly a criminal act, for the prohibition against Lashon Hara, which we said earlier is even for telling the truth, is even when speaking about an individual. Certainly for an entire city in Israel who hold to the faith in God, this is certainly a great sin. So he makes the statement that if a person says, I am going to assume that the negative traits I associate with a particular person from a race apply to the race as a whole, then they're guilty of Lashon Hara about the race as a whole. Right? And people think it's not as bad. Because you could say, well, I didn't mean you. I meant, you know, people from that group in general. But all the more so, right? Because then you're speaking about people who you know don't deserve to be insulted. And I gave you a link in number 21, and I sent out the sheets in advance. You could click on it instead of having to type it out. And when I send out the follow-up email from tonight, I'll send out the source sheet as well, I expect, and then you'll have the link that way. But this is Rabbi Feldman's lecture, the audio recording of his lecture. He talks about this issue at length, the issue of Lashon Hara and communities. But because of this, because we don't believe in the idea of characterizing a group in a negative way, we have particular statements from leading authorities in Jewish law that are against that sort of racist stance. In 22, I brought you Rabbi Moshe Feinstein, who was the leading rabbinic authority in North America for the second half of the 20th century until he passed away in 1986. He was dealing with the case of Ethiopian Jews. Ethiopians who came to Israel, and there were some who did not want to accept them as Jewish. Now, it's a fascinating legal debate whether they were Jewish, weren't Jewish, needed conversion, didn't need conversion. That's not my point. My point is what he wrote about the motivation for not accepting them. He said, "And I was very pained to hear that there are such people in Israel who refrain from drawing near the Ethiopians in spiritual matters, causing them, God forbid, to be lost from Judaism. It appears to me that they do this only because their skin is black. It is obvious that one must draw them close, not only because they are no worse than other Jews, and there is no legal distinction due to their blackness." Same idea, Rabbi J. David Bleich in source number 23, writing about, as you see the title, Black Jews, a Halachic Perspective. Judaism is colorblind. Skin pigmentation is unknown as a halachic concept. The problem of determining the status of the various communities of black Jews is totally unrelated to color. The sole issue is that of Jewish identity. I also brought you a piece of a poem that I just liked. In number 24, Rabbi Shlomo Aviner, who is a very vocal rabbi on any number of issues in Israel, wrote a poem about the Ethiopians and about how they are Jewish just like I am Jewish, and it doesn't have anything to do with their color. Now, having said all of this, right, I want to wrap up this portion of it by noting what I said in the beginning, which is my question was, is Judaism racist? Is there room for racism in Judaism? What I didn't want to ask was, are Jews racist? Because the reality is that there are Jews who are racist. I, and I'm fairly sure I'm not the only one in this room, have heard Jews tell racist jokes. I'm sorry, it's just true. So why? Why do Jews do it if it's not a product of Judaism? And the simple answer is because Jews are human beings and live within society as well. But I think it's also part of the Jewish experience. I think that Jews, certainly in North America, not exclusively, but certainly in North America, had a sense of victimhood. And it helped them to feel better about themselves when they could look down on another race and say, we are better than they are. There was also an element of fear. Rabbi Carmi, in his essay, I quoted a big piece of it in number 25, but I'm not going to read it aloud in the interest of time, but you can see it there, talks about the fear involved in growing up in an area in Brooklyn a couple of generations ago, and how you were under attack. And that led people naturally into that kind of animosity, that kind of hatred that would enable a racist approach. I think that's part of it. I think it's all part of it. But it's certainly not an expression of what Judaism thinks. So to conclude this section of what we're talking about, Judaism distinguishes between Jews and non-Jews because we have a covenant of responsibilities to God that is not race-based. Biblical sources can be read in different ways regarding racial identity, and they have been. Jewish tradition does tend to generalize about entire races. You do find it, but it acknowledges that it may not apply to each member, and if it's only presenting a default, people can break away from the default. And it's very against making negative statements about a group, even as it's true Jews have done it and frankly continue to do so. Questions on this before we move on to racial diversity? Okay, then let's go further. What about the value of racial diversity? So as we outlined before, the Law Society of Ontario wants to promote racial diversity. Sorry, Morris?
Hi. There's one issue that I'm aware of, and it has to do with modern infertility techniques. And I know there's a big discussion amongst certain portions of the Jewish community whether it's appropriate to use non-Jewish, say, for example, sperm donors. And the reason given is that it contaminates, the words I heard, contaminates the purity of the Jewish race. not sure if you're hearing it.
I mean, as a general, I don't know which circle this is originating from, but generally speaking, Jewish law is against the idea of a sperm donor other than the husband in general, having nothing to do with whether the donor is Jewish or non-Jewish. In other words, the stance normatively, and there may be outlier cases that are unique, but the normative stance within Jewish law is that among those who endorse IVF at all, they want it to be the husband's sperm, not sperm from somebody else.
The husband's incapable. I'm talking cases where the husband's incapable.
Yeah, so what I'm right. So what I would say is that the trend, and this is you can go to my medical ethics class for more on this, because we did have one on it a couple of years ago. But the majority view within Orthodoxy is, number one, that where the husband is incapable, you would not use from somebody else. In other words, a donor would not be sought. And number two, not to go ahead with it where it's a single mother. Whether that's right or wrong, whether that's something you like or don't like, that's a great discussion for medical ethics, lecture, and I can litigate it right now, so to speak. But it's...
you could have a black convert father having a child.
Yeah.
Sort of, wipes out that idea that was posed.
Right. I mean, unless you're going to make some kind of a claim that when somebody converts, their soul changes. Which, is discussed. Don't laugh. There are those who make that claim. But, sorry? Color doesn't change, I think. I think that's still true. In terms of racial diversity, so the Law Society of Ontario is looking to promote racial diversity for three reasons. And if you take a look at source number 26, you see it from the Stratcom study. More than 4/5 of racialized and 3/5 of non-racialized licensees agreed that racialized licensees face much more or somewhat more challenges to their entry into practice and advancement compared to their non-racialized colleagues. In other words, everybody is agreeing. It's only a question of degree that racialized licensees are having a harder time with entry into practice. At least half of respondents in both groups agreed that the challenges faced by racialized licensees impact the reputation of the legal system in Ontario. You see the percentages. Affect access to justice for Ontarians and affect the quality of legal services for the public. And again, for the first two of those, you have a majority of non-racialized saying that, not for the third one. And then last, asked if the increased number of racialized lawyers and paralegals would have a positive or negative impact on the public of Ontario, 82% of racialized respondents indicated it would have a very positive or somewhat positive impact. This compared to 76% of non-racialized respondents. Everyone seems to be, not everyone, I shouldn't say that. The majority seems to agree, whether they are personally racialized or not, that it would be to the advantage of the public, it would be to the advantage of the legal profession, and it would be to the advantage of racialized licensees themselves to promote racial diversity. That's the conclusion of the Law Society of Ontario based on the studies that were done. Now, interestingly, the Law Society of Ontario does not make the argument that diversity is good for the workplace itself. I read a whole bunch of papers on this, and it's fascinating to see the literature on it because it's not uniform. Meaning there are certain aspects of benefits that come with diversity that some identify within the workplace, but there are also those who argue that it actually is damaging within the workplace. So they're not making that argument, but I think it's an interesting point, the very fact that they don't make that argument. Joey?
I don't think this has anything to do with racialized because diversity is something that Chinese are being prejudiced by this whole business, so they're not.
Well, they are. They're within the groups that are mentioned.
No. But
I mean, I read the study.
They ended up not getting into law school at Harvard, for example, because they're giving specific benefits to certain segments of racialized people.
Right.
The ones that are the ones that are perceived as disadvantaged.
Right.
It has nothing to do with racialized. It has to do with, you might think it's disadvantaged. And that would mean don't give kids grades in school because the ones who aren't as good as those. Once you seem to be brighter, somehow it's a bet. The whole world works
I'm not sure I would go from A to B there. I think there are a couple of stops in between. But in terms of the... Right.
Which is the same thing as the school.
Right.
It has nothing to do with racial necessarily, but it's arguing for the best.
Right, but this...
The public, the best. I think they say no. Okay, but if not, I say that this is, in effect, certain groups that are racialized will be...
Right. I hear what you're saying. I think the argument in response is that there are a lot of different factors which affect whether someone is a good lawyer for a particular person. And it isn't only about the grades that they got or whether they were on law review. And I think there's something to be said for that. I don't think that's a small thing. And outside of the practice of law, meaning having a psychologist... Right, outside of law now. Having a psychologist who has a good understanding of the cultural background of a particular patient will make them better suited, even though their grades aren't as good as a different psychologist. I think you have to acknowledge that there is this other element, involved. Sergio.
I think that I remember this debate when they were producing the studies, and there are a couple of things. First of all, the people who responded to the surveys that were sent out were overwhelmingly minorities, because they had a vested interest in the study to come out a certain way. That's number one. A lot of people that got the surveys basically ignored it. They said, oh, another survey. That's number one thing. Number two thing is that you have to take into consideration that the law schools now make a more than concerted effort to enroll, to admit into law school people who, not based on merit, but based on basically race. There is a quota for Aboriginals. There is a law school in Thunder Bay that is exclusively for Aboriginals, for example. And there are, for many, many years, a lot of law schools had a rule that there have to be 50% women at least, or 50 or certain number of minorities, and those are unwritten rules in the name of diversity. So what are you going to have at the other end in terms of economic? When this survey was taken, it was like very difficult for people to find a job. So obviously there is pressure. It's like a pressure cooker, right?
So I hear what you're saying. I hear what Joey is saying also. I'm going to take one more hand on this just because he had his hand up before, but I don't feel any obligation to either defend or attack the findings of StratCom and the Law Society, because it's not, number one, it's not my expertise, and number two, it's not really the point. The question is looking at this as a value or not. I would note that they're giving you percentages of the non-racialized licensees who answered also. So it's important to recognize they're not only telling you these are the answers of the people who felt they were personally excluded.
Right.
You have to note that. Yeah.
It's also a fallacy to argue that one man's conduct, idea of merit, is actually has merit. So saying that the grades a person got is the be-all and end-all of everything is a fallacy, because it may well be that somebody who was disadvantaged and had inferior grades is in fact smarter and more capable than somebody who had all the advantages and got better grades.
Why do you assume the others had all the advantages? Why not assume that they were disadvantaged?
So I'm going to let you debate this out because this isn't where I'm going. In terms of the values that are set out by the Law Society, meaning wanting to help people get jobs, wanting to provide better legal services for the public, and improving the image of the legal profession. Those three goals. How will Judaism look at it? So first of all, helping people get jobs is an easy one in Judaism. Source number 27, Rabbi Moses Maimonides, articulates 8 levels of charity, and the top one, the highest level of tzedakah, of philanthropy, beyond which nothing is higher, to give him a gift or loan, or create a partnership with him, or provide him with work, to strengthen his hand until he no longer needs to ask from others. That's what we go for. Similarly, there's a Mishnah in Pirkei Avot, which says, Yihyu aniyim b'nei veitecha, paupers should be members of your household. So usually people translate that to mean, welcome the needy into your home. That's not how Maimonides reads it. He says what that means is if you're hiring people to work in your home, hire people who are needy. Make sure that you give them a job. So the value of helping people to have access to work, you know, that's straightforward. Similarly, the idea of access to justice, we actually talked about that in this room a couple of years ago when we talked about pro bono work. But if you take a look at source number 29, the biblical text, you shall have one justice for yourself, like stranger, like citizen, I am Hashem, your God. One justice for everybody. Everyone should have access to justice. The issue of improving the image of the legal profession is less of a concern of Jewish law. Jewish law doesn't seem to be terribly concerned about the reputation of lawyers. I apologize, it's just the facts. However, Judaism does add two other elements regarding the importance of racial diversity. If you take a look at source number 30, Rabbi Kamenetsky quoted part of this source earlier. This is that Mishnah that he quoted about how human beings are created first with Adam and Eve. This is why man was created as an individual. And it gives a whole bunch of reasons why. And among them are for peace among people, lest one say to another, my ancestor was greater than your ancestor, as we said. But also, lest races say there are multiple gods and each one created different human beings. And to proclaim the greatness of God. For a person mints many coins with one seal, and they all resemble each other. And the blessed, holy King of kings minted each person with the seal of Adam the first, and not one resembles the other. And I bring you this source, not because it's an early understanding of DNA and mutation, although you could read it that way, I suppose. But because it's making a statement that diversity, the fact that one person doesn't look like another, the fact that you have different races, that you have different traits, that that's actually built into the plan from the start. That God wanted it. He wanted to start with one and to create variety. And you see it in source number 31 as well, which describes a blessing to be recited upon seeing a large crowd of Jews. Why? For their intellects do not resemble each other and their forms do not resemble each other. The idea that variety is part of God's plan. So that obviously is not an argument the Law Society is going to make for racial diversity, but it is an argument that Judaism is going to make for diversity. Is that there's a divine desire for diversity. And then last, within this, also an argument that Judaism is going to make is that diversity is valuable for the sake of practical benefits for human beings themselves. Let me explain with a question. When the Jews start out as a nation, there's a whole scramble because of a confusion about who Jacob is supposed to marry, or maybe it's clarity about who he's supposed to marry, but his father-in-law switches his daughters, and ultimately Jacob ends up being married to four wives, and has 12 sons and a daughter out of these four wives, and the result of that is hostility from the children of one wife versus the children of another wife, and the result is that the brothers sell Joseph, and the Jews end up as slaves in Egypt, and you have tribal hostility thereafter. It's the story of Jewish history. One tribe having an animosity towards others. The tribe of Benjamin says to the others, don't mix in my affairs. The tribe of Judah ends up being the royal tribe, inspiring the ire of certain others, and so on down the line. And yet, God chooses to preserve tribal identity. When the Jews travel in the wilderness on their way into the land of Canaan, they travel by tribe. They camp by tribe. They come into the land and they are assigned tribal portions. Each tribe has its own space. If you think tribalism is bad, then why didn't you just say, here's the land, go live there? Why did you insist on dividing them up by tribe? Why was that a good idea?
You had to realize that there was inheritance.
That didn't require tribes. It would have been a lot simpler, actually, if you didn't have tribal land. Right? Because you had tribal land, you had a problem of situations in which women end up inheriting land and then they marry a man who's from a different tribe and the tribal portions get scrambled. It would have been a lot easier if you said there are no tribes anymore, everybody just live together. It would have worked a lot better. So there are different answers that you could give. Each tribe has unique traits and you want to preserve the traits. That's one possible explanation, which takes us back towards racial identity. But I think also there's an element of security that comes when your tribe is identified and you aren't made to give up your tribal identity. When you're, you know, this goes to the whole multiculturalism issue, which I didn't really want to open up, but I suppose I'm alluding to it anyway. But when people are told, forget your identity that you had before, now you're just part of the mob, they tend to get hostile. They tend to feel threatened. Whereas when they're told, you can be who you were, just be loyal to the whole, then they feel a lot safer. I think that's an element as well, but it speaks to a Jewish value of, yes, honoring that which is diverse. Which brings us to the third and final part, which is, can you compel diversity in the workplace? Clearly the law society thinks it can, or at least, you know, before the election from a couple of weeks ago. If you take a look at source number 32, it says LSUC because it was done in 2016 when they were operating under their old name. Yes, I know, they're the Law Society of Ontario. Series of recommendations. Recommendation number 3, the adoption of equality, diversity, and inclusion principles and practices. The Law Society will, 1, require every licensee to adopt and to abide by a statement of principles acknowledging their obligation to promote equality, diversity, and inclusion generally, and in their behavior towards colleagues, employees, clients, and the public. Flip the page. Number 2, require a licensee representative of each legal workplace of at least 10 licensees in Ontario to develop, implement, and maintain a human rights/diversity policy for their legal workplace, addressing at the very least fair recruitment, retention, and advancement, which will be available to members of the professions and the public upon request. 3, require a licensee representative of each legal workplace of at least 10 licensees in Ontario to complete every 2 years an equality, diversity, and inclusion self-assessment for their legal workplace to be provided to the Law Society. And 4, encourage legal workplaces to conduct inclusion surveys by providing them with sample templates. Okay, that's an awful lot of requirements.
Right.
So, I don't know how many of you sent me this article, but I'm putting it on the source sheet so that you don't need to keep sending it to me. Number 33. Lawyers opposed to diversity initiative dominate LSO board elections. One of the Law Society of Ontario's key diversity initiatives could be in peril with the election of a slate of lawyers to its board of directors who are committed to scrapping it. At issue is the legal regulator's statement of principles, a requirement that every lawyer and paralegal adopt a statement, which they can write themselves, that acknowledges their, quote, obligation to promote equality, diversity, and inclusion. The requirement was one of 13 recommendations made in 2016. It quickly drew the ire of some lawyers who argued it is compelled speech and unconstitutional. That criticism spilled over into this year's Law Society Board of Directors election, in which a slate known as Stop Sop, if it works for you, fine, were victorious Wednesday, taking 22 of the 40 lawyer seats on the board. The slate campaigned on striking down the statement of principles. I believe the stop-stop slate was elected because so many lawyers object to being told what to think, what to say. We do not believe there should be an ideological litmus test for being allowed to practice law in this province. Independent lawyers are essential in a system based upon the rule of law. And when the regulator takes on the task of supervising the values that individual lawyers profess, that independence is in doubt. So I don't know where it's all going. I'm not claiming any knowledge. Sorry?
Down the tube, hopefully.
I have no idea, and I'm certainly not taking any sides on it. But my question is, from a Jewish perspective, how do you look at this sort of compulsion? Would you say Judaism is, which I've already argued, is against racism in general and promotes racial diversity? What would you say Judaism would say regarding compelling these sorts of things, a statement of principles, as an example?
Oh, Judaism wouldn't compel.
compelled you to admit that you are racist and to atone for it. In fact, this assumes that everybody is a racist.
Does it?
Wow. What you have to know is how racist.
How would this have worked out for the Beatles in 1965? We have to have racial diversity for the Beatles. That would have worked out wonderfully.
It's an interesting question. Julius! No, it's an interesting question. I don't know.
Corded with one Yiddish sentence, Zion Mech. And it's amazing how people in our profession don't do that. And there's a question, systemic, this is the topic on systemic racism.
Mm-hmm.
I learn more by having lunch in the lunchroom at our firm than I do at a partnership meeting. If you had the Maple Leaf hockey team, two defensemen, and they only spoke Russian, on the ice, you wouldn't care what language they spoke if they
wanted to
stand
on the cup. Yeah, that's not
some
happening.
Some of the downtown law firms, I am told by Asian employees have been over the years, don't let their employees speak foreign languages to each other. If I had to get a deal up by midnight, I wouldn't care what language the clerk spoke as long as the deal went up the door.
Okay. Yes.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to tell you something that I said at convocation that you might find of interest. Engendered some hostility, but I'm going to repeat it, and I agree with it. When I was a teenager, at one stage, I didn't feel like going to shul in Shabbat morning. So, what my father did, my father put my suit on my bed, and came upstairs from having breakfast and reading the morning paper. I saw my suit there, and I said, why is my suit on my bed? And my father said, because you're going to come to shul. So I said, Dad, why do I have to go to shul? I'm a good person. I know what's right, what's proper. What do I have to go to shul for? So my father said, because you have to listen to what the rabbi has to say. Because sometimes you need a reminder. Quite frankly, what the Law Society asks us to do is not upset me. I can see the Law Society mandating something that would upset me, and I would object. But this particular statement asked to say, it's not upset me. I don't tell you, this whole controversy is going to give us a real left eye in the eyes of the general public.
I hear you. Yes, Raquel.
I 100% agree with that. I also think, I can't speak to whether Judaism would say about, a secular or professional regulated body imposing obligations, but what does Judaism think about the imposition of supervisory values of the community? I think that's what Judaism does. It imposes values. The idea that, constitutionally you can make more sophisticated things, I don't know. I mean, I'm not a constitutional lawyer. I can see the argument. But the deep resistance that I've heard from primarily white lawyers against this notion that I just have any obligation to contribute these issues, and that maybe when I act in certain ways in my professional life, I think I'm acting neutrally and I'm not acting in any sort of negative racial way, but maybe it's time to be them sometimes. I don't see that as so. I wonder a lot about the pushback.
Right, so I'm gonna actually go further with this because having heard the comments that were made, I want to pick up in particular on what Raquel said about what Judaism does in general, because I think that's really the key point here, which is Judaism does a whole lot of requiring, including in areas like this. If you take a look at source number 34 on your sheets, Judaism absolutely requires certain supportive elements for others, just baseline, before you get into hiring issues, just basic support of others. This is about what's called in Hebrew ona'at devarim, in English that translates as verbal abuse. The biblical text from Leviticus, you shall not abuse each other. This is verbal abuse. How? If he, the person you're talking to, had repented, they did something wrong and then they made right, you should not say to him, remember your first deeds. If he was descended from people who had converted to Judaism, he should not say to him, remember your parents' deeds, what they did before they became Jewish. If he had converted and he had now come to learn Torah, he shouldn't say to him, the mouth that ate non-kosher will now learn the Torah spoken by the mouth of God. Don't say things to others that are going to cause them to feel bad. That's a basic. That's not about hiring. That's just about basic conduct towards others. When you get into compelling hiring, though, and that's really more than the statement of principles. That's not necessarily what the statement requires. But if you're going to try to go in the direction of saying that people have to hire certain others, that's where it gets dicier. There is, of course, a principle within Judaism, which is that the law of the land is the law. And it is possible to argue that when the law of the land assigns regulation of a profession to a particular body, that applies to what the regulating body says. That's debatable. But that concept exists. But the challenge is, are you going to recognize law of the land within Judaism if you're talking about something which helps one population but potentially hurts a different population? And that was hotly debated for a long time in Jewish law in a completely different context, that of rent control. The question of, can you, within Judaism, require landlords to cap what they're charging for rent in order to benefit tenants? If you take a look at source number 35, Rabbi Shimon Greenfeld, in his Tshuvot Marashag, was against rent control. He said, true, this is good and beneficial for the renters, meaning the tenants, but for the landlord who rents it out, this is harm and loss for someone else, uses his property against his will. Why follow the renters to call it a benefit and say, well, the government is helping people? Follow the landlords. The house or the store is theirs, and this is harm. And he argued against rent control. On the other hand, source number 36, Rabbi Yoshua Rokeach, disagreed. He says, I have heard from my brother, our great father, who was a rabbi who opposed rent control, recanted. And as he goes through it, I'm going to skip it in the interest of time, because rent control isn't really our topic. But he says, fundamentally, this is a rule that is meant to benefit the population, and the population chose its representatives, and its representatives created the rule, and the rule is binding. That was the argument that he gave. So where you're going to help one population and harm another, it's somewhat controversial within Judaism. But we certainly have plenty of precedent in Judaism for compelling certain conduct within the Jewish community and within its own authority. So the following principles, I didn't even bother to bring it on the page because I felt like once I had 42 sources, it's really enough. But we have the following principles. Kofin al midat sedom. Kofin al midat sedom means that a rabbinical court is licensed to compel somebody to act in a way which benefits others if it will not cost him anything. If I have the means to assist somebody else and it isn't going to hurt me, a rabbinical court can, yes, coerce me to do that.
What if it would hurt somebody else? Not you, but hurt somebody else.
Right, so that's when you get into the...
You're going to get inferior service because you had to hire someone who didn't have the qualifications.
Right, so I'm not applying that case to the diversity hiring. I'm just stating that there are principles in which rabbinical courts are empowered to coerce behavior. That's all I'm saying, whether it's for this or not. We have a principle of kofin al mitzvat aseh, that a rabbinical court can compel people under certain circumstances to actually fulfill the Torah's commandments. Kofin o tawat shiyoma rotza ani, the classic, where a man refuses to give his wife a bill of divorce, and the rabbinical court deems it appropriate for him to divorce her, they have the ability to coerce him to give the get. Rabbinical courts over the ages had a department of weights and measures. They would go around from store to store to store in the community, making sure that people's scales were honest. If anyone has to catch a mincha, I believe that they're davening down the hall. Just to let you know. Not only that, though, it wasn't only about the rabbinical court. Communities had the ability to regulate the economy in order to benefit the community. So we have laws of ona'at mamon, that you are not allowed to gouge on prices. Laws, yes, we talked about it before, ribit, of usury. We have Talmudic precedent for creating enactments which will encourage people to lend money. Take a look at source number 37. Here's a good example of an attempt to benefit the community. There is a rule within the Torah that says that after a child is born, a woman brings a set of birds as a sacrifice to the temple. So once, bird offerings in Jerusalem cost gold dinarim. Very expensive. They went up in value. Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel said, "By the temple, I will not sleep tonight until they cost standard dinarim." He says, "I'm going to drive the price down." How'd he do it? He entered the court and taught. A woman who needs to bring offerings for multiple births or multiple impurities brings one offering. You said he had multiple children, you only need to bring one offering. You reduce the demand, and the price goes down. Bird offerings drop to a quarter dinar that very day. Application of that later in Jewish history, number 38. If vendors elevate the price of fish that Jews want to purchase for Shabbat, it will be appropriate to create rules banning the purchase of fish. No more gefilte fish. When the store drives up the price before Pesach and they say now it's 12 bucks for you to get a loaf that was $7.99 just a couple of weeks ago. Make a rule. No gefilte fish. Simple as that. No one will buy. Demand goes down. The price will go down as well. My point is, you see community regulation of economy in order to benefit the community. And that's a basic principle. I'll give you one more example of it in source number 40. A reality of Talmudic times was that Jews would find themselves kidnapped and held for ransom. And in the event that you didn't pay the ransom, you would be sold as a slave. So the communities would get together to ransom those who had been kidnapped. But there's a fear. If you pay the ransom, you encourage them to kidnap more people. So, take a look at source number 40, where the Talmud legislated, one may not redeem captives for more than their value. More than their value means more than they would have gotten on the slave market. Due to tikkun ha'olam, to repair the world. And the Talmud asks the question, what is our concern here? Is our concern the burden on the community of ransoming this person? Or is the concern that if you ransom them, then you're encouraging the kidnappers to take more captives? And the answer in the discussion is that actually both of them are concerned. So even if I can afford personally to pay the ransom for someone, I'm not supposed to do so because it's going to harm the community. So what you're seeing here is the ability to legislate conduct for the benefit of the community as a whole. And now to apply it back to the racial diversity issue. The question is whether the value at hand, racial diversity, rises to the level where the Jewish community ought to legislate for it. Meaning, pretending this question was not in front of the Law Society of Ontario, but was in front of the Law Society of the Jewish community. So what would we do? And the answer is, it really depends on how seriously we view this issue of diversity and what the reason is to do it. Meaning, some of the reasons are not really compelling as a matter of Jewish law. Saying it's to improve the image of the legal profession doesn't really cut it. Saying it's part of God's plan that there should be diversity is very nice, but that's not a legal argument. Seeing it as beneficial for the racialized licensee is strong, but it still doesn't lead to employment per se. There are other ways to help people besides legislating this. However, some of the motivations may well warrant that kind of communal pressure. If you take a look at source number 41, we do not appoint authority over the community with fewer than two, meaning anytime you appoint someone to a leadership position in the community, you have to have at least two people involved. You have to have a check, in other words. It can't just be one person. Someone else has to be able to be a check on him. How do we know this? Rav Nachman says, you go back to the Mishkan, when the Jews built a tabernacle, a temple, as they traveled through the wilderness. So when they collected, it says, they shall collect the gold. There was a plural. Meaning, tzedakah collection requires multiple people because it's an element of authority. What is the authority that's involved? So Rav Nachman quoted Rabbi Bar Avuah to say, Because what can tzedakah collectors do? They're able to claim collateral for tzedakah pledges and even on a Friday. Meaning, if a person was supposed to pay a certain amount to tzedakah and didn't do so, the communal tzedakah collector could go into your property, even on Friday afternoon, and take stuff and say, we're holding this until you pay up. Right? Next time you complain about the robocalls for tzedakah or the people who are knocking at your door, this is nothing. Right? They could. No, literally, the communal authority could. I wrote pledge here, but the truth is the authority was greater. They could decide, you have to give this to the communal charity fund, and failure to do so means we're going to knock on your door politely, and then we are going to walk through the door, and we are going to take your property and hold it until you pay up on what we believe you meant to pledge in the first place. And the point that I'm making by bringing this is to say coercion of tzedakah, of financial aid for others, is licensed talmudically. The idea that you'd be able to compel people to do something that will benefit others financially is not foreign to Judaism. And similarly, in terms of enabling access to justice, if you believe that racial diversity is necessary for the sake of access to justice, take a look at the last source, number 42. It talks about what residents are required to do for the community. We force him, a new resident, to build a gatehouse and door for the yard. Their urban geography was such that they had houses that were all built off of yards. So you have five or six residents who are all abutting a yard. He has to contribute towards the gatehouse and the door for the yard. We force him to build a wall, doors, and a bolt for the town. You live in a place. You have to pay for communal defense. There is a requirement. We tax the community members to help the community. So to sum up this last point and make what I'm trying to say clear, but just before I do that, just a note again, for those who came in late, make sure please that you sign in on the sheet in the back. I will not be able to grant you credit. Otherwise, I did have someone take a couple of pictures, which we use sometimes in the event that somebody says they were here, but their name isn't on there. So we've used that to say, oh, they really were there. And it was just a mistake in transcribing things from the sign-in sheet. But to sum this up, within Judaism, there is debate as to whether a government is able to harm one population in order to benefit another. That's not clear. But religious authorities do seem to be able to do so. That's a secular government. Religious authorities seem to be able to do so, particularly when it comes to regulating the economy for the benefit of the community. And racial diversity may warrant that kind of activism if it's to help people who need jobs, and this is what's going to do it, or to provide access to justice for the public. The argument really can be made to support it. I don't think it's clear cut, but I think the argument can be made. Thank you very much.
Thank you.